Good morning. I'd like to bring the House Committee on Business and Labor to order. We've got a pretty long agenda today, and so hopefully everybody's had a chance to look at the amendments and the bills before us. We're going to start at the top of the agenda and open a work session on House Bill 2471.
Mr. Chair and committee members, this measure you heard first day of session, February 2nd. It's a measure that changes the qualifications to practice as a funeral service practitioner or an embalmer, including qualifications related to reciprocity and apprenticeship, declares an emergency. There's now a dash 2 amendment that deletes the proposed requirement that the license applicant from another state has to have practiced at least 1 year immediately preceding application, and recognizes that the license issued in another state, as long as it's substantially equivalent, replaces references to apprenticeship with the word trainee. There is no revenue impact and there's no fiscal impact.
Thank you.
Chair Hovey, I move the dash 2 amendments to House Bill 2471.
Representative Barton moves the dash 2 amendments be adopted to House Bill 2471. Discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, it's so adopted.
To the floor?
Yes.
Chair Hovey, I move House Bill 2471 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Barton moves 2471 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Seeing none, Matthew, can we have a vote?
Representative Barretta?
Aye.
Representative Doherty?
Aye.
Representative Aye.
Evans?
Aye.
Representative Fagan?
Yes.
Representative Hurd?
No.
Representative Nuss?
Excused.
Representative Widener?
Aye.
Vice Chair Martin?
Aye.
Vice Chair Gunmer?
Aye.
Chair Holby?
Aye. House Bill 2471, having received the votes, is passed. Carrier? Volunteers to carry?
Perhaps Representative Nose would be good at it.
Here, you've got to carry it.
I'm sure he'd be good at it.
Okay, I'll take that. Representative Nose, carry. We'll close work session on House Bill 2471. Open a work session on House Bill 2472.
Mr. Chair, committee members, this measure was heard February 2nd. It's the bill that modifies the authority of the Mortuary and Cemetery Board to conduct investigations on the premises and the records and the records of facilities that provide services related to the final disposition of human remains. Repeals statutes on a magistrate-issued warrant for the inspection of facilities. There is now the proposed dash 1 amendment that restores deleted provisions that the board inspect biennially and restores provisions that the board will employ persons to perform the inspections and that the inspections won't be performed by a board member or person actively engaged in the board regulated practice. It allows the board to establish shelf inspection program to supplement the biennial inspections and allows the board to adopt rules setting criteria by which the exempt operating cemeteries will not be subject to inspection.
Representative Barton.
Chair Hovey, I move the dash 1 amendments in House Bill 2472.
Representative Barton moves to adopt the dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2472. Is there discussion? Seeing none, any objection? Seeing none, the dash 1 is adopted.
Chair Hovey, I move House Bill 2472 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Barton moves House Bill 2472 to the as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Seeing none, Matthew?
Representative Barretta?
Aye.
Representative Doherty?
Aye.
Representative Escobar?
Aye.
Representative Evans?
Yes.
Representative Fagan?
Yes.
Representative Hurd?
Aye.
Representative Nuss?
Excused.
Representative Widener?
No.
Vice Chair Barton?
Aye.
Vice Chair Gennemer?
Aye.
Chair Holby?
Aye. House Bill 2472 is moved to the moved to the floor. And Carrier? Representative Kinnemer, thank you. Close the work session on House Bill 2472. Open a work session on House Bill 3242.
Mr. Chair and committee members, this measure permits the Mortuary and Cemetery Board to assume control of an insolvent, bankrupt, or disowned cemetery for the purpose of carrying out existing pre-arrangement sales contracts. directs the board to adopt rules, declares an emergency. There is now a -2 amendment that replaces the original measure. It allows the board to grant a temporary operating permit for the purpose of performing the interment in the cemetery that does not have a valid license. And it restricts granting that permit to situations in which there's an existing pre-arrangement sales contract. And it directs the board to adopt rules regarding the temporary operating permits. And it sunsets its authority to grant these permits January 1 of 2018. Declares an emergency. There is no revenue impact, and there is a minimal fiscal impact.
Chair Hovey, I move the -2 amendments in House Bill 3242.
Senator Barton moves -2 amendments to House Bill 3242. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, any objection? Seeing none, the -2 amendments are adopted.
Chair Hovey, I move House Bill 3242 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Barton moves House Bill 3242 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Widener.
Actually appreciate these amendments. They help out quite a bit. I was a little nervous because there's a lot of cemeteries that are in disarray that are around the country, or around the state, I should say, and country, and but some of them are owned by like the Freemasons and different groups like that. And I've talked with some of the different mortuaries around about some of these issues, and I think this actually gets to what we need to do for this situation. So appreciate the -2s.
Thank you.
So I think it's been adopted. So we have a motion pending to the floor, I think.
Yep.
Is there any other discussion? Matthew, can we have a roll call?
Representative Moretta?
Aye.
Representative Doherty?
Aye.
Representative Esco?
Aye.
Representative Evans?
Aye.
Representative Megan?
Yes.
Representative Hurd?
Aye.
Representative Nose?
Aye.
Representative Widener?
Aye.
Representative Vice Chair Barton?
Aye.
Vice Chair Kenmer?
Aye.
Chair Holby?
Aye. House Bill 3242, having received the votes, has passed. Representative Widener, would you like to carry it since you're excited about it? We'll close the work session on House Bill 3242.
I will leave all the puns out of that.
I do want to adopt the -2.
Let's suspend the rules real quick and let Representative Nose vote on the first two bills.
Chair Holby, I move to suspend the rules for the purpose of allowing Representative Nose to vote on House Bill 2471, House Bill 2472.
Representative Barton has moved to suspend the rules to allow Representative Nose to vote on House Bill 2471 and House Bill 2472. Is there any objection? Seeing none, the rules are suspended. Representative Nose, how do you vote on House Bill 2471?
I'll vote yes.
Representative Nose votes yes. Representative Nose, how do you vote on House Bill 2472?
I'll vote yes on that also.
Thank you. With that,
to inform him that he had the opportunity to also carry one of those.
Yeah. Yes, you can carry House Bill 2471.
I'm not having a really good launch this morning, Mr. Chair, just so you know. No.
It is about embalming, so. With that, we will open a work session on House Bill 2594.
Mr. Chair and committee members, this measure requires the insurer or the liable party to pay the actual cost of emergency response provided by private emergency responders. There is now the -1 amendment that modifies the definition of a private emergency responder to include only the hazardous materials response teams and those working under the direction of such teams. There's no revenue impact and there's no fiscal impact to the -1.
Thank you. Representative Barton.
Chair Hovey, I move the -1 amendments in House Bill 2594.
Representative Barton moves the -1 amendments be adopted to House Bill 2594. Is there discussion? Seeing none, any objection? Seeing none, -1 is adopted.
Chair Hovey, I move House Bill 2594 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Barton moves House Bill 2594 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Discussion? Seeing none, Matthew, a roll call vote, please.
Representative Moretta?
Aye.
Representative Doherty?
Aye.
Representative Esquivel?
Aye.
Representative Evans?
Aye.
Representative Fagan?
Yes.
Representative Hurd?
Aye.
Representative Nose?
Aye.
Representative Widener?
Aye.
Vice Chair Barton?
Aye.
Vice Chair Kenmer?
Aye.
Chair Holby?
Aye. This bill 2594 is passed. Representative Buckley will carry that bill. Close the work session on House Bill 2594 and open a work session on House Bill 2958.
Mr. Chair, committee members, this measure provides that limited license that a rental company obtains to sell insurance in connection with a renting a vehicle also extends to the rental company's employees and their designated agents. It becomes operative 91 days after the effective date, declares an emergency, no amendment, no revenue impact, no fiscal impact.
Chair Hovey, I move House Bill 2958 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Barton moves House Bill 2958 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion?
Brief comment, Mr. Chair.
Yes, sir.
I don't actually believe this bill is necessary under existing law. This is a clarifying bill. Arguably, they already have the authority to sell this insurance. In fact, more than arguably, I'm pretty sure that they do. This clarifies it so that there's no question. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. So noted. Any other discussion? Seeing none, Matthew?
Representative
Brown? Aye.
Representative
Escobar?
Aye.
Representative Evans?
Yes.
Representative Bacon?
Yes.
Representative Nose?
Aye.
Representative Nose?
Aye.
Representative Weidner?
Aye.
Vice Chair Barton?
Aye.
Vice Chair Kemmerer?
Aye.
Chair Holby?
Aye. House Bill 2958, having received the votes, is passed. And Representative Bentz will be carrying that bill. Close the work session on House Bill 2958. Open a work session on House Bill 3186.
Well, Mr. Chair, committee members, this measure deletes language prohibiting the advertising or the promotion of outdoor mass gatherings without a permit. Clarifies the circumstances when a permanent development may occur on the land where the mass outdoor gathering takes place. Declares an emergency. There's no amendment. There's no revenue. There's no fiscal impact.
Chair Holby, there's no amendment, correct?
That's correct.
Chair Holby, I move House Bill 3186 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Barton moves House Bill 3186 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Seeing none.
Mr. Chair. If you don't want me to.
Representative Weidner.
We have a carrier.
I will be a no on this bill, and I would be glad to carry it. So, because this does affect my district. Because we do have a lot of events with wineries and everything. My county deals with these issues very well. There's a process set in place, and I think the process is working right now. So, I will be a no. Thank you.
Any other discussion? Seeing. Representative Barreto?
My understanding is this kind of eases up the requirements and clarifies them to where it says may instead of shall, and it allows the counties then to have a little bit more say in it, if I'm not mistaken.
It's a pro-liberty
bill, right? Well, that's an interpretation. I don't know that we definitely share that. But
can I just add that? The bill currently to hold these outdoor mass gatherings, they must have a permit, and they cannot advertise or promote the event until that permit is issued. This bill is saying that they still need the permit, but they can go ahead and promote and advertise before the permit is issued.
And just one more clarification too. It is for a pretty select group because it is a mass gathering. Mm-hmm. I don't remember the definition of mass.
Over 3,000.
And an event that continues for more than 24 consecutive hours.
Thank you. That's okay. Another criteria. Sam
Vescovel.
Now, thank you, Mr. Chair. The only one that really is out any money is the people that advertise, so it's nothing to do with the population, the public, or anything else. It's just up to the individual.
They don't get. Any other discussion? Seeing none, Matthew, can we have a vote?
Representative Barreto?
Aye.
Representative Escobar?
Aye.
Representative Evans?
Yes.
Representative Fagan?
Yes.
Representative Hurd?
Aye.
Representative Nose?
Aye.
Representative Weidner?
No.
Vice Chair Barton?
Aye.
Vice Chair Kemmerer?
Aye.
Chair Holby?
Aye.
House Bill 3186 having received the votes is passed. Representative Williamson's bill.
It is.
Representative Williamson will carry. Close the work session on House Bill 3186. And skip over the next one for a moment. Second thought. Let's stand at ease for a moment.
That means we go to.
I'd like to reconvene the House Committee on Business and Labor, and we're going to open a work session on House Bill 3236.
Committee members, this measure limits the enforceability of non-competition agreements to 1 year. It applies to non-competition agreements entered into or on after January 1, 2016. The Dash 2 amendment limits the enforceability of those agreements to 18 months instead of the proposed 1 year.
Thank you.
Chair Hovey, I move the Dash 2 amendment to House Bill 3236.
President Barton moves the Dash 2 amendment to House Bill 3236. Discussion? Representative Widener.
All right, Mr. Chair. I'll support the 18 months. I'm a little hesitant and will watch it just because I do live in this industry where, I mean, I'm subject to it where I can move to a different company. I'm taking inside information to that other company for doing things or where I'm starting a new business. I have hired people, been sued for hiring somebody who was under a non-compete clause and everything as well. But the process that we have set in place worked very well on establishing it. He just couldn't go into pre-existing customers. There's lots of different things that take place in this industry, but 18 months sounds reasonable, and I will support the 18 months, but watch it closely to see if it does harm any industry. So,
Representative Barreto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would just as soon leave it at 2 years. I think that's safer, and I understand the argument against, but 2 years has worked and sounds good to me.
Representative Evans.
I recognize the concern on this as well. The 18 months was basically in the middle between what was proposed and what industry was kind of looking at. And I, too, will be watching this, and if it needs to be adjusted in the future, certainly willing to entertain that. As I understand it, the 18 months is an upper cap of many other factors that are sometimes involved in this process. So,
Can I, Mr. Chair, can I add to that? Mm-hmm. I appreciate that. I think coming from a small business background, 18 months, you know, given 2 years, I mean, in order to for a business to grow, especially when they're starting out with a new idea, it just takes a while to do that unless they have an infusion of capital, which a lot of small businesses don't. And so to protect the small businesses, they're just starting in that direction, I would like to give them the 2 years. So that's my argument.
Thank you. So I assume we have objection to the Dash 2 amendment?
On my part, yeah.
So Representative Barreto objects. Anybody else object to the Dash 2? So noted for Representative Barreto. With that, Representative Widener is fine. So the Dash 2 amendments, having received the required votes, is adopted to House Bill 3236.
Chair Hovey, I move House Bill 3236 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Barton moves House Bill 3236 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Seeing none, Matthew, shall we have a vote?
Representative Barreto?
No.
Representative Doherty?
Aye.
Representative Esquivel?
Aye.
Representative Evans?
Aye.
Representative Fagan?
Yes.
Representative Hurd?
Aye.
Representative Nose?
Aye.
Representative Widener?
Aye.
Vice Chair Barton?
Aye.
Vice Chair
Hennemer?
Aye.
Chair
Holbit? Aye. House Bill 3236, having received the votes, has passed. And it's Representative McLean's bill, so he shall carry that one. Close the work session on House Bill 3236. Open a work session on House Bill 2803.
Mr. Chair and committee members, this is a measure that deals with the beverage container redemption centers. The committee heard the discussion on the Dash 8 amendment, made many provision changes. I will point out specifically that it removed the requirement for OLCC to inspect the premises of certain dealers and instead requires OLCC to ensure compliance by those dealers, and also for gives OLCC the authority to impose additional civil penalties of at least $200 for each day of noncompliance after the 60-day notice period. There is a fiscal statement issued, and there is a revenue statement issued. It just came in while we were meeting, and it is on OLIS, but the revenue impact is indeterminate, and it's involving the $200 fine.
Thank you. The Dash 8 amendment.
Chair Holvey, I move the Dash 8 amendment into House Bill 2803.
Representative Barton moves the Dash 8 amendment be adopted to House Bill 2803.
Mr. Chairman, my records show we adopted the Dash 8 amendment on the 9th. I could be wrong.
No, it does ring a bell,
probably
actually.
Right.
So I think the amendment is in there. But
maybe we like it.
I think it might be.
You are perfectly right.
Oh, thank you.
Yes. Yeah, still got it. Yeah, look at this guy.
Yeah.
I tell you.
Hey, way to go.
Paper doesn't lie.
Old star.
No, I tell you, some of us old timers, we can still do it. Okay. Yeah. Thank you.
Chair Holvey, I withdraw my motion. Do we need to suspend the rules to do that, or can we just withdraw the motion like civilized people?
Representative Barton has moved to withdraw his motion. Is there any objection? Seeing none, the motion's withdrawn.
Thank you.
To the floor.
Does
it need to go to Ways and Means?
No.
Great. Chair Holvey, I move House Bill 2803 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Barton moves House Bill 2803 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion.
$200 a day fines.
Representative Widener.
Mr. Chair, I will be a no on 2803. I think we really should be looking at possibly doing away with the bottle bill. I travel the country all over. I don't see bottles in the ditches in other states that don't do it. I think redemption and recycling is working very well across the country. A lot of the bottles right now in testimony and energy environment, we hear how the recycling centers are receiving a bunch of water bottles, and with us looking at driving the price to 10 cents per bottle and can, I don't think Oregonians can afford this, and I think it's time that we look at catching up with the rest of the states at this point. So I will be a no.
Thank you. Any other discussion? Representative Hurd.
So the Dash 8, thank you, Mr. Chairman. The Dash 8, it states, is that correct, that after noncompliance, it's a $200 a day fine? Is that right, at the bottom?
That's correct.
Is there a cap on that, or does it just keep going?
It's at least $200 for each day of noncompliance after the 60-day notice period.
It's a little heavy-handed for my taste, so it's probably going to be a no because of that.
Any other discussion?
Yes.
Tim Kinnemer?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, this also included an increase in the amount of deposit? No.
No.
So. Okay, thank you.
Any other discussion? Representative Barreto?
Yeah, does it require more? It seems like the testimony we had in here was from Oregon Grocers or someone, and they said, you know, they need to take the hit on most of this because a lot of the smaller companies aren't complying or aren't taking the bottles in. And does this bill then force the smaller companies all to get involved in doing that and buying the equipment to do that?
I see. That's how it is, I guess.
Would somebody from the grocers like to come up?
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, Amanda Dalton on behalf of the Northwest Grocery Association. Chair Holvey, Representative Barreto, the amendments you adopted last week do not expand the authority for the redemption centers outside of, I believe it's 5,000 square feet or over 100,000 bottles collected annually. So if you're under that threshold, you continue to do take back, count individually at the counter.
Oh, I see.
Representative Barton.
A question for you, Ms. Dalton. Thanks for coming up, by the way, on no notice. Always dangerous in work sessions.
Especially last week.
But as I recall, not to name names, but of the free riders that this bill was getting at, two of the more prominent ones were Walgreens and Grocery Outlet, or at least that was the case in my district. Is that true statewide?
Chair Holby, Representative Barton, that is accurate. Walmart is now a participating member of the Redemption Center. Walgreens remains not a participating member.
Thank you. Other discussion? Were you aware of anybody that was opposing this bill strongly? I don't recall any opposition testimony.
Chair Holby, we were not.
There was none at the hearing.
Okay. All right. Thank you. So where were we?
The motion is pending to the floor.
So is there any other discussion? Seeing none, Matthew, can we have a vote?
Representative Barreto?
Aye.
Representative Del Rey?
Aye.
Representative Esquivel?
Aye.
Representative Evans?
Aye.
Representative Fagan?
Yes.
Representative Byrd?
Aye.
Representative
Nubbs? Aye.
Representative Weiner?
Nope.
Vice Chair Barton?
Aye.
Vice Chair
Kenneman?
Aye.
Chair Holden?
Aye. Good idea. House Bill 2803, having received the votes, is passed. Representative Evans?
Yes.
Did you want to carry this bill?
Yes, I would.
Okay. Yeah, rest out. No, I would.
This one would. Close the work session on House Bill 2803 and open a work session on House Bill 3164.
Mr. Chair, can you remember this measure? Modifies the meaning of a change in retailers' competitive circumstances. It's the bill that deals with the farm implement retailers. Clarifies the conditions under which the supplier may, with good cause, terminate, cancel, or not renew the retail agreement or change the retailer's competitive circumstances. And it increases from 12 months to 18 months the length of notice that the supplier must provide the retailer before terminating, canceling, or not renewing. And the proposed -7 amendment is before you. It modifies the meaning of good cause, rewords many provisions without substantially changing the meaning, and it maintains the notice requirements and the time to cure the deficiency, and it declares an emergency. There is no revenue impact on the -7, and there's no fiscal impact.
Thank you.
Chair Holby, I move the -7 amendments into House Bill 3164.
Tim Barton moves the -7 amendments to House Bill 3164. For discussion, Representative Kinnemer.
Mr. Chair, as I understood, there is agreement on the -7s but not complete agreement, and the notion is that it would go to the Senate and there would likely be another improvement or another addition, maybe I should say.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Roger Beyer, here representing the Pacific Northwest Hardware and Implement Association of Oregon. So Representative Kenemar is correct. We have been negotiating on this bill quite lengthy since the first hearing. And while there is agreement on the -7s, we have not reached complete agreement on the bill. And we are committed to continue to work with the manufacturers to try to reach agreement as the bill moves through the House and before it is acted on in the Senate. Right now, literally, we're one word apart from agreement. And hopefully we will get to that agreement point before you have to see the bill again.
Thank you. Other discussion? Appreciate that. Is there any objection to adopting the -7? Seeing none, the -7 amendment is adopted to House Bill 3164.
Chair Hovey, I move House Bill 3164 to the floor with a due, as amended, with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Barton moves House Bill 3164 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Seeing none. Matthew.
Representative
Barreto?
Aye.
Representative Norrie?
Aye.
Representative Esquivel?
Aye.
Representative Evans?
Aye.
Vice Chair Barton?
Aye.
Vice Chair Kenemar?
Aye.
Chair Holden?
Aye. House Bill 3164, having received the votes, has passed, and Representative Bentz and Representative Hoyle will co-carry the bill. That'll close the work session. House Bill 3164. Let's open the work session. House Bill 3377.
This measure authorizes the employee to request a flexible or predictable work schedule. The committee had a public hearing on March 3rd. There is a proposed -1 amendment. It replaces the original measure. It's very similar to the original bill. However, it applies requirements for the written notice of the schedule change and compensation for shift changes only to be applied to the non-salaried employees. Also grants the labor commissioner the authority to enforce.
Is there a proposed amendment to this bill?
That was the proposed amendment. It replaces the original measure.
Gotcha. This is, okay. Mr. Chair, could we stand at ease for a moment?
Yeah.
Thank you.
We'll stand at ease. I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 3377.
There is no action. It's closed. Okay. Are we expecting this to return? May I ask that?
You'll find out at the end of the meeting.
Okay. Okay. You know, my members have some pretty strong feelings about this matter. Thank you. Okay.
So let's open a public hearing on House Bill 3508.
This measure allows community college instructors who received, I'm going to talk about the -2 amendment because that replaces the original measure, and the -2 amendment came from the sponsor of the bill, Representative Gorsuch. The -2 codifies the presumption that an instructor at a community college does not have a reasonable assurance of continued employment under an offer of employment that's conditioned on the enrollment, funding, or the program changes, and it thereby allows the unemployment benefits for the community college instructor to receive between two regular terms.
Thank you. Let's have David Reeves and Alita Wright. Before we get started, just so the audience knows, the only other bills we are going to have any action on today or hearing will be 3488.
Will we carry anything over officially?
We will be carrying some bills over as well. So, excuse me for that. If you'd introduce yourself for the record, please.
Members of the committee, my name is Alita Wright.
And I'm David Reeves, President of American Federation of Teachers, Oregon.
Go ahead and begin your testimony.
Good morning. I'm Alita Wright, and I'm a part-time faculty member of the Computer Applications Department for Portland Community College. I've been employed with PCC for 13 years, and I've also taught at Clackamas Community College and Mount Hood Community College from about 99 to 2003. I've been what they call a freeway flyer. I urge your full support of HB 3508, and here's why. So I'm at PCC. I'm a member of the 76%. That means roughly 3 in 4 instructors are part-time or adjunct faculty members. We are the majority of the teaching staff, yet we live in constant fear and jeopardy of losing our classes. In my department, we have certain minimum class size requirements for a class to go. I typically commit to teach a course at least 4 to 6 months prior to its starting. However, due to the fact that the state has decreased funding support for higher education, coupled with the decrease in enrollment and other outside factors beyond my control, I've come to the realization that it may no longer be feasible for me to remain an educator. I teach Excel. I know how to crunch the numbers. When I did an analysis of my declining income and my declining teaching assignments, this startling fact came to light. I work for a little over minimum wage. Last year in 2014, my total income from teaching after 13 years on the job was $27,000, a little tiny bit of change, which is roughly a 20% decrease in wages over the year 2013. The future does not look very bright. As a single mother of a middle school child, I must provide a stable home and income base for the both of us. I have much more in common with a seasonal timber worker, a retail salesperson, or a barista shift worker than I do with a highly educated, well-qualified teaching professional. When the woods are closed due to weather conditions, or the retail worker sees their hours and wage slashed, or the construction worker is laid off for lack of work, all of these job classifications allow for unemployment benefits with no questions asked. There is a myth that has perpetuated for far too long about the glory or the prestige of being a college professor, but I testify here and I say that it's a lie. We're starving, invisible, and exploited contingent workers. In essence, I'm no different than any of the seasonal shift workers that I've mentioned here. It is time to look at the facts and meet the people, like me, who live with the possibility of furlough every 12 weeks. Some of us barely get by. Some of us do not turn on our heat because we can't afford it in the winter. Some of us regularly use the Oregon Food Bank Community Pantry to shore up our home pantry. My child still needs to eat. I have taught for the past two summers. I've been lucky to get one class, which means that I'm lucky to take home about $250 a week. At that income level, I do qualify for food stamps. I won't know until about 72 hours before classes start if I will have enough students on the roster for the class to go. This is a problem for students who have to scramble for to find classes at the last minute because of the class cancellations. It's also a problem for instructors who suddenly find they have zero classes and zero income. I will, in every sense of the word, be laid off for lack of work through no fault of my own. I should have the ability to receive unemployment benefits because each 12-week period is a separate and distinct employment period with no guarantees for the future. Again, I urge you to strongly support this bill, HB 3508. Thank you for your time.
Good morning, Chair Holvey, members of the committee. Again, I'm David Reeves, president of American Federation of Teachers. I'd just like to give you a little background on this bill. More than half of faculty in community colleges in the U.S. are part-time or contingent or adjunct, whatever you want to call it. As you heard from Alita, at our college, Portland Community College, at 76% of the classes currently are taught by part-time instructors. And unlike other job classifications, if you work in education and you want to apply for unemployment compensation, you have to demonstrate you do not have reasonable reassurance of reemployment. That is from term to term. You do not have reasonable reassurance of reemployment. As you've heard, these faculty appointments for adjuncts for contingent faculty are on a term-by-term basis, and many faculty don't know really till 72 hours ahead of time, or honestly, I think I remember the first day of class or the first week of class, really just looking at enrollment to see if my class would run or not. And that's where we're saying that adjunct faculty do not have reasonable assurance of employment. There's nothing reasonable about that. It's a very contingent position. This is really a matter of fairness. The precarious working conditions, this term-to-term employment that adjuncts do. And the issue really here is an adjunct instructor can get unemployment compensation during fall, winter or spring term if those classes are canceled. Summer term is the exception due to really this archaic law that really recognizes a system in the past where all the instructors were 9 months a year and it was a summer vacation or summer break, whatever you want to term it. It wasn't a summer term. And that's really what's at odds here with the law. And certainly we don't want people that are on 9 months appointments, have full-time positions. We don't want them double dipping or taking unemployment compensation in the summer. That's not fair. That's not right. But, you know, I taught 15 years as an adjunct at Portland Community College. I taught every summer those 15 years. I always got my appointment. I think most instructors do. If they're assigning you the class, they're intending it to run. You're taking that class on, you're intending to teach it. We're talking about the occasional time circumstance it happens that that class gets canceled and it happens to be in summer term, and that's the exception to the rule that you are not eligible for unemployment compensation. So we're really talking a matter of fairness here. I'm really speaking for the career adjuncts like myself, like Alita. People, this was our career. You know, I taught English as a second language. I wasn't just a lawyer or architect or engineer in the day, and then I came in to teach at community college as a vocation or something I was bringing from my trade. This is what I was trained in, was teaching. There just are no positions open for full-time regular positions. So I would teach at Portland Community College, teach at Mount Hood Community College and such, but I relied on four terms a year. It was no way was I taking off three months a year not to teach. So we're really asking you to recognize there is no reasonable assurance of employment and institute this safety net for the fourth term of the year, for summer term. Thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Questions, Representative Evans?
Yes. Thank you, Chair Holby. I just have a couple questions just so we make sure we're clear about this, because I think sometimes when people talk about college professors, they're thinking of the folks that maybe teach, for example, two or three classes a term, have research assistants, et cetera, et cetera. What we're talking about here, I was an adjunct instructor for 5 years on and off between the times I had to go fight a war. And it was not uncommon that in order to put together enough money to pay the bills, I was teaching at two or three different institutions. So the question is this. When you talk about this particular bill, can you explain the definition of what an adjunct professor is or an adjunct instructor is? It's not the person that teaches one class a year for vanity. It's somebody that actually is teaching multiple classes and has been locked in for a class, right? Is that yes?
Yes, yes, that's our intention. It's people, their department runs summer classes.
Right.
You know, that's the expectation, and they teach summer classes too.
So another follow-up question then is, could I say that it is a general happenstance, perhaps not common but not uncommon, that when an adjunct instructor is given a time frame, they lock in their class on a schedule because classes happen at different times during the day, and they may actually say no to other classes to say yes to that one. So if it doesn't make because of enough students, they're kind of out of luck with both classes. Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah, I teach Tuesday, Thursday.
Right.
So I'm available other days of the week.
So just the market sometimes changes, so you've actually said no to something because you've given your commitment to something else, but that class may not make.
Yeah.
And I also have to give my commitment well in advance.
Right.
Well in advance.
Thank you.
And that's exactly right. I went taught at Portland Community College and at Mount Hood Community College at the same time, and either juggle schedules between the two colleges or even within the college among departments.
Last question, if I could, Chair.
Follow up.
Let's say you have a contract with a community college or university. At community colleges I'm familiar with, it was common that a full load would be four or five classes, as opposed to the full-time load of perhaps one class less because of advising and things like that. Is that still so? We're not talking about a person that teaches as a full-time adjunct only 3 or 4 hours a day. You're teaching multiple different classes throughout the day and the week. Is that correct as well?
You want me to tell you what I teach five sections.
Thank you.
And I also was 5 days a week. I taught through over four terms, full-time instructor would teach over three terms the same load I taught over four terms a year.
And at a less pay.
At one college. I mean, I was also working at other colleges on top of that to try to make the money. Yeah, yeah, exactly. That's why I had to work multiple colleges.
Other questions? Member Barreto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You had mentioned that over half of the professors are part-time. Are those made up of any that have retired and then come back, so they've gone on retirement and then come back? Because I know over at Eastern, you know, they've hired quite a few of those because they don't have to pay the benefits package after they retire.
That would be some, but if you're looking at a typical community college, especially in a metro area, most of those instructors are what I would call career adjuncts. That really is their career. You will always have, yeah, and this bill's not aimed at people like that, retired things, right. People like that, that are just, you know, doing an occasional class or something to help out. Yeah. So there will always be a few like that. There will be a few, particularly from industry or something, that might teach some things. But if you're looking at a community college, the Department of English, Department of Math, Department of GED, liberal arts, those are, you know, even sciences, those are mostly instructors that are relying on that. That's their income. That's what they were trained in, and that's the only positions they can find.
Vice Chair Barton?
Yeah, go ahead.
To your point, Representative...
I had a follow-up.
Go ahead. I think it relates to this, that Chemeketa Community College, for example, in the speech communications department, has 5 full-time and 29 adjunct.
Wow.
That teach not just one class. They teach 3 classes or more.
Representative Barreto.
Yeah, follow-up to the last one. Then does this bill prevent those that are coming back and retired and coming back from applying for unemployment under this bill?
I believe the way we have it written, it does, with protections in there for somebody teaching the previous term and then going on to summer and expecting it. And if it doesn't, we're willing to have amendments made that would protect against that, certainly, because that's not our intention.
Okay. Any others? Any other comments for this panel? Questions? Did you have something, Representative Canterbury?
Yeah, just I guess more comment. I know a little bit of this. Of course, a lot of times what community colleges do is they try to bring in expertise for a class or two. I was a clinical psychologist, so I taught at Mount Hood Community College a couple of terms, one class or two, and at a number of other colleges throughout the region. But it was purely a supplement to my income. It was not a predominant source, although I did have very bitter employment experience there. And I will not talk about it today, but someday I probably will. But I don't know. This is not an easy problem to solve. One of the things that has me quite concerned is apparently we don't have anyone from the community colleges to speak, and I'd love to hear their side of the story. And I appreciate you coming today.
And like I said, Representative, we're not aiming the bill at people who have...
No.
This is a more vocation for them. I'll also say Washington State has a very similar law, and we can look at their usage over time, too. Because we're not... I'm confident we're not talking about a large majority of people. It's really a safety net for those that need it.
Back to you, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
Okay. Any other questions, comments for this panel? Thank you very much for coming in. Thank you.
Thank you
for your moving and personal testimony.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Next up, I think we have someone from the Employment Department. Please. But Representative Canterbury, to your point, nobody has signed up from the community colleges.
That's what I checked with Jan about. Thank you.
Chair Hovey, Vice Chair Barton, members of the committee. For the record, David Gerstenfeld, Assistant Director for Unemployment Insurance at the Employment Department. The department is neutral on House Bill 3508, but wanted an opportunity to talk about, from our perspective, how we think it plays out, and importantly, some of the impacts of how it relates to federal law. There are some special provisions in the unemployment insurance program that deal with people who work for educational institutions. And the summer break is where it is the largest impact, so that's the example I'll be using. And it does essentially do what you heard. It says that if you work for an educational institution during one term, so the term before summer break, and you get reasonable assurance that you'll be working for them in the subsequent fall term, that you generally are not eligible for unemployment insurance over the summer term. And that's the fundamental issue that this bill in the various forms of the amendments looks to address.
Excuse me, I'm sorry, I misunderstood.
Representative Kimmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is that federal or state law?
Chair Hovey, Representative Kenemer, both. There are some federal requirements. So the federal law does require that states have these special provisions for one category of workers. It permits but does not require them for another category of workers. Under federal law, they require that you look at educational institution employees in two groups. One group they call the professional employees. Those are instructors, people that do research and administrative work. And then the other category is everyone else. So today we're talking about instructors. That's what House Bill 3508 addresses. The bill is originally drafted. I was able to talk to the Department of Labor and give them a copy of that bill and the original proposed -1 amendment so that they could look at it to see if it was consistent with federal law. We do that because if the federal government says that we are out of conformity with federal law, there are some pretty dire consequences for the unemployment insurance program and for Oregon businesses. The federal government can stop paying the money that we use to administer the unemployment insurance program. That's about $50 million a year. And importantly, they can also remove the credit that Oregon businesses receive against their federal unemployment tax, their FUTA tax obligation. If Oregon were to lose that credit, that would be about an extra $500 million per year in business taxes that Oregon businesses would have to pay. So that's why we try to make sure we're not going to run into that problem ahead of time. So the Department of Labor looked at 3508 as drafted and said that there were several conformity issues with it that were inconsistent with federal law. They looked at the -1 amendment, which was essentially a savings clause. It said that if things violated federal law, that that those provisions wouldn't come into effect. They said that that was an effective savings clause, but only if none of 3508 went into effect, essentially. We've talked to the bill's proponents, and we're working with them, and we'll continue to do so on some other possible amendments. With the -2 amendments, it is modeled after some language that exists in Washington law. And it addresses some of the issues, but we still think there's likely some conformity issues that would come up under federal law. And those are primarily, it imposes a higher burden of proof on the community colleges to show that there is not reasonable assurance than it imposes throughout the rest of the unemployment insurance program. It treats instructional employees differently than the other professional employees of educational institutions, and that's something that the Department of Labor has said you can't do. You need to look at the professional category of employees as a group and not kind of subdivide that. And then potentially also just by treating people that are temporary contingent professors different from other types of workers, that's a potential conformity issue. So the -2 amendments do have a savings clause also that says any of those provisions that are found to violate federal law don't come into effect. There's one other potential conformity issue where there's a definition of the academic year. We haven't received kind of an advanced statement from the Department of Labor as to whether they think that raises a conformity issue. Our concern is that if it does raise a conformity issue, that particular part of the bill doesn't have that same savings clause. So the -2 amendment as drafted, that academic year definition would come into play even if the Department of Labor did not say that it was consistent with federal law. If the provisions were found to be consistent with federal law, then it would allow people to be eligible for benefits over the summer break. That's something that we could administer. There's some other provisions in the bill that we don't think raise conformity issues, such as people who originally get reasonable assurance, and then later on after the fact they end up not getting offered the job for the fall term, that they could retroactively receive benefits if they claimed and were eligible over the summer. We don't believe that raises a conformity issue. We would require some operational changes on our end, which we certainly can do. The fiscal impact of that is really the amount of the benefits that would be paid out to the workers. That's the biggest fiscal impact. We don't know how many people would fall into this category and would claim those benefits over the summer. Our estimate is that it would be about $4,400 or $4,500 of benefits for each of those workers who did receive the retroactive benefits. Most of the businesses that we're looking at are reimbursing, so it wouldn't have a direct impact on the overall tax rate for Oregon businesses, but the institutions that they worked for would be required to reimburse the trust fund for any benefits that are paid out. We will continue to work with the bill's proponents on this. Our big concern is making sure that the bill doesn't proceed in a way where there would be a risk of Oregon being found out of conformity with federal law, and making sure that if there's a savings clause that it would apply to everything so we don't accidentally run into challenges. There are some other technical things that we'll continue to work on, such as making the change effective at the start of the calendar quarter is just easier for us and for businesses in terms of reporting wages and doing some other things. And with that, it's a rather technical area, so I'm hoping I answered the questions, but certainly happy to answer others that members may have.
Thank you. Questions? It certainly seems like this is a pretty technical issue, but also an issue of fairness as well. And so I appreciate you continuing to work on a solution to this.
Great.
However, I'm not sure it will be able to be done in a timely manner enough for this committee to take action on it. What's your time frame for, you think, for working out the potential solutions that you expressed and also checking in with the U.S. Department of Labor and getting that kind of feedback? What's your best guess?
Chair Holby, for the feedback from the Department of Labor, we're usually able to get that relatively quickly within a few business days.
Wow.
Once we actually have the language. Now, that is the unofficial version, but it's the same people that do the official review, so I don't think that will be a big time problem. I think working through exactly how this would play out in all the details could take a little bit more time. If we're just talking about making sure that the savings clause applies to all parts of the bill, I think that's a relatively easy fix that could be done pretty quickly. So I don't have a definite time frame. That's something that we'll continue to talk to the bill proponents on. My guess is if we're able to do it, we could probably come up with draft language within probably within a week.
Good. Representative Nose.
Mr. Chair, I just want to thank the proponents for bringing this bill forward. I think they've exposed what I think is a big problem with the way faculty are treated, and I think a lot of people don't understand this, or I didn't realize what was actually going on in this workforce. And I would just ask that if we don't have this bill perfectly worked out, you know, that the Senate is another body that could look into it further and perfect the amendments if we're not able to do that in a timely manner. I hope we're able to move this bill.
Thank you. And did you have any conversations with community colleges about this issue at all?
Chair Holby, we haven't. We really didn't have time to discuss it with them. Our focus has really been on the conformity piece. So I think the real challenge will be coming up with language that gets at the heart of this issue and whether that can be made consistent with the federal requirements.
All right.
So we certainly will reach out to the community colleges as we work on additional amendments.
I'm sure they're probably aware of this bill, and they don't seem to be too worried about it.
No, they're all hanging out in the hall watching.
I appreciate your testimony. I appreciate you working on this, too. I think it is a issue that warrants some attention.
Thank you.
Is there anybody else that wanted to testify on House Bill 3508?
Mr. Chair,
Barton.
I want to echo the comments that I think I've heard from that have been bipartisan, that I don't know what's going to happen with the bill in the next week. There's a lot happening. However, if the community colleges have sentiment on this, either way, they need to weigh in on the record. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. I don't disagree.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Widener.
I know a lot of people see the issue and everything here, but I hope we don't rush into something then that would affect every other business and have them paying more on their unemployment insurance or put us at risk of penalty. So I would hope we would trust David in getting things right on this.
Yeah. Certainly we'll heed the Employment Department's advice on avoiding that scenario. Seeing no other people signed up to testify, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3508. And I was hoping that Sean Jillians wouldn't be back in time. But we'll go ahead and open a public hearing on House Bill 3488.
Mr. Chair and committee members, this measure requires the proceeds of a fee, commission, or other payment to a declarant or other person upon the transfer of interest in real property to be used exclusively to benefit the property or to support the activities directly benefiting the property residents in order for the affordable housing covenant or restrictions to be exempt from the prohibition of such a fee, commission, or other payment. And there are no amendments.
Good morning. Welcome to the House Committee on Business and Labor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, Sean Jillians, representing the Oregon Association of Realtors, here today in support of 3488. Mr. Chair, you might be familiar with this subject area, private transfer fees. In 2009, the legislature made the decision to actually prohibit them, and the bill was sponsored by the then chair of the Consumer Protection Committee, one Representative Holvey from Eugene, and the bill passed unanimously through the legislature. You might remember, Mr. Chair, in the middle of it, the bar had some concerns with the way the bill was originally drafted. And so on the Senate side, we completely rewrote the bill to address those concerns. And one of the sections that we had in there that we had worked on kind of with the affordable housing advocates was this piece about making sure that we still allowed affordable housing to have these sort of fees that would benefit the actual properties there. Land trusts are the prime example of where you sort of capture some of the equity in there and you ensure that the properties remain affordable. Since the time that we implemented the bill in 2009, Freddie and Fannie at the federal level have come out with rules regarding private transfer fees. Oregon was a little ahead of the game there, and the feds started catching on of what they are. And basically, for the committee who folks who weren't here at that time, a private transfer fee basically is an individual or developer puts in a latent fee in the deeds, in the deed, in the form of a covenant most of the time. And it says that on the first sale, it doesn't actually kick in, but on every subsequent sale, a percentage of the sales price reverts back either to the original owner or what we were seeing at the time in around 2008 was a private company was coming in. And they were taking 50% of the proceeds to administer these fees. They were causing all sorts of title issues because they were sort of a dormant fee sitting in there that no one realized until the second or third sale kicked in. So you guys took the proactive step. Freddie and Fannie have now come out and said that they will not securitize mortgages that have these fees on them unless very specific criteria are met. And I submitted, it's in OLIS, sort of a quick little one-pager from Freddie and Fannie about what their standing is. The bill would simply conform to Freddie and Fannie and say for these affordable housing fees, it actually has to benefit the subject property or the residents within the community of the subject property. I've talked to John Van Landingham, who is fine with the language. He sort of worked with us the first go-round and another attorney. So that's what you have before you. It actually is, shockingly for us, Mr. Chair, a pretty non-controversial bill, and I think I'm probably the only one signed up because I'm the only one nerdy enough to actually get into this stuff. With that, I am more than happy to answer any questions, Mr. Chair.
Representative Barton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Really appreciate your nerdiness. On that note, can you talk about how these covenants or transfer fees intersect with the rule against perpetuities?
Mr. Chair, as the vice chair knows, I forgot the rule against perpetuities right after I took the bar, and hopefully I will never have to bring it back up again. We have had one debate on the record over it where I sort of remembered it, and I think that was probably a long time ago as well. I think there actually, at the time, to be honest, though, with you, Mr. Vice Chair, I think there was a claim when we were prohibiting these that they could violate the
actually,
rule.
Actually, all joking aside, I think they might.
Yeah, I think they do as well, which is sort of why we took the proactive step. And the other thing I'd add, which I didn't really explain very well, why it's important that Freddie and Fannie won't purchase these mortgages. The vast majority of mortgages are sold on the secondary market, as you know. And if people can't, it basically eliminates conventional financing if it can't be sold on the secondary market.
Representative Widener.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, think I do remember this, Sean. This is the one where a guy would basically put a lien or any sale where he would make $500 or $1,000 every time it was sold. Because I thought, wow, this is a great scam. Why didn't I think of this at the time? So, and this is just cleaning up what I'm looking at going through. It's just some language changes for Fannie and Freddie, but it's the same issue that we had that time.
Mr. Chair, Representative Weiner, that's exactly correct. It just tightens up our existing prohibition, brings us in conformance with the language of Freddie and Fannie. And when I first heard about this in 2007, I had the exact same reaction as you, as why didn't I think of this first? But it was a little too clever, I think, and even the feds have picked up on it and prohibited it.
Well, thank you for staying abreast of this issue. You know, I remember it. Do you suspect that the committee on the state bar on the Senate side will rewrite this one, too?
Mr. Chair, it's my intention that we keep it exactly the way it is this time and not rework the entire thing.
Okay. Well, it was a good bill then, and it's a good bill now from my perspective. So I thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3488 and open up a work session on House Bill 3488.
Chair Holvey, I move House Bill 3488 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Barton moves House Bill 3488 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion.
Good bill.
Seeing none.
Because Sal said
so. Matthew, can we have a roll call?
Representative Brown?
Aye.
Representative Doherty?
Aye.
Representative Esquivel?
Aye.
Representative Evans?
Yes.
Representative Fagan?
Yes.
Representative
Hurd?
Aye.
Representative House?
Aye.
Representative
Weiner?
Aye.
Vice Chair
Larkin?
Aye.
Vice Chair
Hammer?
Aye.
Chair
Holdy? Aye. Put this one on the consent calendar.
Yeah, right. We'll get along with that one.
Any objection?
Not, yes.
You want to object to that? Okay.
I'll carry it.
I'll carry it.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, I'd carry that bill.
He's the chief sponsor.
Oh, geez. Sorry.
As is Representative Doherty and myself.
Representative Doherty will help me.
Because we understood this thoroughly.
Absolutely.
I was the chief sponsor in 2009.
I never took the bar, but I knew that whatever Barton was talking about.
Whatever Barton was talking about.
No carriers.
Sal Esquivel, Representative Esquivel, will carry the bill. We'll close the work session on House Bill 3488. Moment we've all been waiting for.
I didn't. Not at all.
Embarrassing. We will be carrying over House Bill 3243.
Good bill.
House Bill 2469. House Bill 2565. House Bill 2764. And House Bill 3508.
The last one, I'm sorry.
3508. Would you like me to repeat those? House Bill 3243, House Bill 2469, House Bill 2565, House Bill 2764, and House Bill 3508. Any other business?
No.
With that, thank you very much for your attention and being here and voting today, committee. Appreciate the work we got done. With that, I will adjourn the House Committee on Business and Labor.